I'm Samardi Moskowain. Earlier this month, archaeologists working in a site called Abydos in southern Egypt announced that they had discovered the tomb of an unknown pharaoh named Senebkai, an evidence of a forgotten dynasty. The excavations have unearthed a royal cemetery and the tombs of an estimated 19 pharaohs or kings. Researchers have been working in this area, which is about 70 miles from the famous Valley of the Kings, for decades. This discovery fills in some of the blanks of ancient Egyptian history, a time known as the Second Intermediate Period. Well, we were intrigued and we asked Joseph Wagner to join us on Radio Times. He's associate curator in the Egyptian section of the Penn Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. He's also an associate professor of Egyptian archaeology in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations. And Joe Wagner, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. No words of very exciting discoveries that you all have been doing in southern Egypt. Describe this Abydos, where you have been working.
Abydos is a wonderful place. It has its origins at the very beginning of Egyptian history. In fact, Abydos is one of the dynamic centers where we can trace the beginnings of Egyptian civilization. The Egypt of the pharaohs emerges in what we call the pre-dynastic period, between about 4,000 and 3,000 BC, and Abydos was a major center in the development of this civilization. In later millennia, over what we call the period of pharaonic or dynastic Egypt, which is about 3,000 BC onwards, lasting over three millennia, Abydos continued to have a major importance. It emerged as the cult center of one of the premier gods of Egypt, Osiris, right, who is the god of the netherworld. So Abydos has a political importance, an economic importance, and also a very important religious importance over the course of Egyptian history. And we're investigating many aspects of this place through time as it evolved in the development of Egyptian civilization.
And I do want to talk about your more recent discoveries, but I know that you and mm-hmm. others have been working there for a number of years now, and it seems like you have unearthed examples, for instance, of bakeries and a mayor's mm-hmm. house. So a lot of interesting discoveries.
Yeah. I started work there actually as a graduate student. I did my PhD field work based on some results that came from this particular part of the site. I've been working in an area called South Abydos, which dates primarily to a phase we call the Middle Kingdom. The Middle Kingdom dates roughly 2000 to 1700 BC would be ballpark figures for it. It's often considered to be sort of a classical age of Egyptian civilization. It's an era where a lot of literature was developed, a lot of the classical literary writings, tales, poetry and whatnot were penned during that era. In later phases, the Egyptians look back to this Middle Kingdom phase as kind of a classical era, sort of looking at, the way we might think of Shakespeare, that kind of thing. They look back to the writings of the Middle Kingdom with that sort of nostalgia. This part of Abydos developed in the Middle Kingdom. What I've been spending a lot of time investigating is a large funerary complex that was dedicated to one of the great pharaohs of the Middle Kingdom named Senwasrit or Sesostris III. He dates around 1850 BC. And what happened is he decided to build a tomb at Abydos. He selected a particular part of the landscape where the high desert cliffs rise up behind the desert. And if you visit Abydos, one of the very striking things about it, it's about 300 miles south of Cairo. It's on the western side of the Nile, and about actually 9 miles from the Nile itself. Uh-huh. On a clear day, you can see the Nile in the distance. But we're really on the very edge of the floodplain, the edge of the Sahara Desert, really. And so it's a very kind of sandy desert environment. And behind that, there are these very striking limestone cliffs that rise up about 800 feet.
Sounds beautiful.
So it's a really beautiful setting. This king, Senwasrit III, for some reason seems to have developed a particular interest in the god Osiris, the god of the netherworld. We have some records from his reign that reflect his kind of intimate relationship with Osiris as he felt it. And during his reign, he chose a place that we discovered fairly recently, the name of it. It's called Anubis Mountain, or the Mountain of Anubis. Associated with the jackal god of mummification, who is also associated, we know in later times, as a protector of the royal tomb. And at the base of this kind of sacred peak called Anubis Mountain, he built one of Egypt's largest tombs. It's a huge structure, goes down about 100 feet into the bedrock, extends about 800 feet in total length beneath this feature called Anubis Mountain. In connection with that, he built a temple and a town, a whole kind of set of elements designed for his funerary cult. He seems to have been buried there, although he also had a pyramid up north. He had two tombs, but...
Sounds like a powerful guy.
He had a lot of money to spend, yes. A very rich king, one of Egypt's largest tombs. And what that did is it established kind of a nucleus for what we now realize in just the last few weeks is really a very large royal necropolis. Kings after Senwazir III in ensuing centuries added their own tombs. Just a couple weeks ago, we identified the tomb of a slightly later king, Sobekhotep I, who is probably the first king of what we call the 13th dynasty. Just a couple of reigns, actually, after Senwazir III. There's another tomb of probably a successor to him. So two kind of later pharaohs within a generation or two of Senwazir added their tombs. Mm-hmm. And then the recent discovery, a whole group of what we were astounded to find to be royal tombs belonging to a lost dynasty that we're calling the Abydos dynasty, including this new king,
Senebkai. A royal cemetery? I mean, would that be a way to understand what you are unearthing, what you've discovered?
In every way, it's kind of like the Valley of the Kings. I mean, the nucleus of it is King Senwazir III's massive tomb that kind of established this is a very important royal necropolis, and we have later kings kind of adding their own tombs. And it seems to have been this local kingdom of the second intermediate period, the Abydos dynasty, who kind of picked this out as a place where they could connect with earlier powerful kings, kind of perhaps legitimizing themselves, showing their own power and religious associations with earlier pharaohs.
And how were you able to literally piece together the identity of Senebkai? Because my understanding is that robbers had gotten into this tomb and had probably stolen a lot of things, but also that his skeleton was kind of scattered all over the place.
It's generally the case in ancient Egypt that tombs, and especially royal ones, were found and looted by tomb robbers, and that's the case with Senebkai.
And that was probably, hundreds of years ago? Maybe thousands?
This was in ancient Egyptian times, yeah. In most cases, we think these royal necropoli they had official guards who kept an eye on things, but of course, after a certain period of time, things begin to kind of fall apart, and especially when there's an economic downturn, the incentive for tomb robbing increases, and of course they knew that there was a lot of gold there, and some of them may have known the the approximate locations of these kinds of tombs.
So, did his tomb look like a mess though when you got inside?
No, the tomb had been broken into through the roof and plundered, so everything that was in there, much of it is gone. What remains of his funerary equipment was kind of scattered around. His body was disarticulated by the tomb robbers.
Meaning scattered all over the place.
It had been pulled out of the burial chamber. There are four chambers composing this particular tomb. The burial chamber is the innermost one and the deepest one. The body of the king and a number of elements of his funerary equipment, which included his canopic chest, in which his organs would have been buried, as well as the lid of the canopic chest, part of his funerary mask, and also parts of his painted wooden, probably anthropoid coffin.
Yeah.
All of that was sort of in a mass mixed up with the bones of the king in the next chamber out from the burial chamber. So they basically pulled apart what was in the burial chamber, probably ransacked it, essentially looking for gold, we think. The canopic chest, for instance, is made out of wood, of cedar wood. It was originally gilded. They simply stripped off the gold and left the shell of the canopic chest there.
Anything inside it? I mean, anything left of the organs that might have been?
Unfortunately, we didn't find the canopic jars that should have been in there. Those were entirely missing. I don't know. There may have been some interest. Right. I don't know what material it would have been made of, but perhaps they made off with those.
So how did you know this was Pharaoh or King Senebkai? How did you identify him?
That was really the kind of the amazing moment of the discovery was we worked our way downwards really from the surface, first finding the entrance to the tomb. It was a little bit like the famous King Tut, where they found the entrance and they made their way inwards, finally cracking through the sealed door and seeing all the wonderful material inside. Not quite like that, because it is a robbed tomb, but that feeling when we got to the burial chamber, where it's a beautifully constructed chamber made out of limestone blocks, just beautifully painted with very sort of charming images of a series of goddesses, beautifully painted in polychrome, different colors.
And obviously well preserved, too.
Yeah, well preserved. It had been damaged. The roof was gone through the actions of the tomb robbers. But these beautiful painted scenes. The identification of the king's name was relatively easy because it is inscribed in hieroglyphs, painted in hieroglyphs on the walls of the burial chamber. So we have his full name. He calls himself the good god, the lord of ritual, the lord of the two lands. The two lands are northern Egypt and southern Egypt. And the king of upper and lower Egypt, Woser Ibre, that's his throne name. And then son of Re, he connects himself, Re is the sun god in Egyptian religion, connects himself with, with Re. Every king is the son of the sun, as they say. So he's the son of the sun, and Senebkai. So his name is inscribed there, and he's connected with various deities in the inscriptions.
And do we know how tall he was, how long he lived, what he might have died of? Is there any evidence of that after, 3,500 years?
We did a preliminary analysis of the skeletal remains. I was fortunate to have a couple great graduate students out there who worked on the skeletal remains. They were able to sort of piece it all together and do some preliminary work on it. We know he was about 1.75 meter, which is like 5'9", 5'10".
That's so pretty tall, wouldn't it be, for that age?
Decent height for these times, yeah. I mean, the average was quite a bit lower than that, I think. He was a pretty robust fellow. His dentition wasn't all that great. We were actually missing his mandible, but we have the upper part. We had his skull, the upper part. His teeth were fairly worn down, which you find pretty commonly in ancient Egyptian skeletal remains. I mean, their diet was such that there's a lot of grit in the food. So, I mean, the molars tend to be sort of ground flat, and that was the case. That was a good indication of his age. He probably died in his late 40s, around 50 or thereabouts.
Of perhaps natural causes?
There was no indication of the reason of death, yeah. We'll be doing follow-up work on the skeletal remains. One of the exciting things about this find is that Senebkai seems to be one of the very early pharaohs of this dynasty, the Abydos dynasty. And we've been doing work in areas around it and identified a series of additional tombs. Some of them we worked on last summer as well and discovered in those they were extensively looted, much more so actually than Senebkai's. No identification, but remains of other bodies as well. And we have two other bodies, partial mummies, that are likely also to be kings.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation with Joseph Wegner. We're talking about a discovery, some work that's being done in Egypt, an important discovery about lost and found pharaoh, a forgotten dynasty. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents Tuesdays with Maury, January 28th through February 16th. Adapted from the best-selling book by Mitch Albom, this is the true story of a mentor's undying need to teach life's most important lesson. Tuesdays with Maury at Bristol Riverside Theater. Tickets at 215-785-0100 or brtstage.org.
Even the cleanest of homes can sometimes be visited by the contemptible cockroach. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the non-toxic ways to get rid of or prevent this odious invader. Plus, answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, after years of economic trouble and painful cutbacks, state governors are delivering annual addresses that are full of hope and optimism for the future. We'll check in on the state of the states. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. Archaeologists working in Egypt to have found the skeletal remains of an unknown pharaoh named Senebkai, who reigned more than 3,000 years ago. The site where they've been working is called Abydos, about 300 miles south of Cairo. Researchers have been digging and discovering evidence of a forgotten Egyptian dynasty. And one of those diggers, researchers, is our guest, Joseph Wegner, associate curator of the Egyptian section of the Penn Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. Any questions or comments you might have, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. As you describe this burial ground and this Abydos, it seems that notions about death and burial seem very important, and of course Osiris as well. Is that sort of typical of Egyptian belief systems at the time, the importance of death and thinking about death and what happens to the body?
Yeah, this was a very important thing to the Egyptians. I mean, they weren't really, you know, obsessed with it in the way that we tend to interpret their visions of the afterlife, but they were very cognizant of the fact that, you know, our life on Earth is very short, and, you know, they were interested in kind of the possibility of an eternal existence. And so their religion is really integrally part of that, is the notion of continuity into an afterlife realm. They connected it with various different gods. One of the very important ones is the sun god Re, who, according to Egyptian religion, goes through this kind of daily cycle of birth and maturation, and he almost dies every day, but rises again on the eastern horizon, you know, passes overhead again. So they really tried to tie into this kind of, you know, mystical power of the sun. They didn't understand that the earth was, you know, orbiting the sun, but, you know, that it was rising and setting. So the sun became a model for eternal existence. And then other gods are tied to that. Osiris, the pharaoh of the netherworld, or the god of the afterlife, he's kind of the archetypal model of a pharaoh who has died. He has a very elaborate myth where he's murdered by his jealous brother, Seth, and then mummified by his wife Isis, helped by the god Anubis, the jackal god. It's a very elaborate, a dramatic religious
myth. I think I've seen that movie, but I don't know.
It's a fascinating one. It goes on and on.
Yes.
But the core of it is the notion that you can physically survive death through treatment of the body, and mummification that's really the model for mummification in ancient Egypt. So for Abydos, this is significant because the Egyptians actually believed that Osiris was a historical being, that this god had lived on Earth and was buried in a certain place, and they connected Osiris with Abydos. Mm-hmm. They thought his tomb was located in an actual part of Abydos, today called Umm El Gab, where a series of early tombs of the first pharaohs of Egypt were located. So there's this, as we study the history and development of Abydos, you can trace kind of the change from history and realities of the past into sort of a mythicization, kind of melding on this kind of religious aspect to it, actually identifying the tomb of one of the earliest pharaohs as the tomb of Osiris himself, and a whole kind of set of religious rituals and ceremonies and beliefs kind of gel around that.
And what's the significance of removing the organs and putting them into their own box, their own special place?
That's also talked about. It's embedded in the Osiris myth. The whole reasoning behind it is discussed there. The organs are protected by specific deities, and there are four gods called the four sons of Horus who are connected with the organs themselves. They also protect the body itself, but and then four specific goddesses, the ones that actually appear in Senebkai's tomb. Their names are Isis, Neith, Selket, and Nephthys. They're the four guardian goddesses of the king's organs. It was essentially important to remove the organs so that the body doesn't decay. I mean, they realized that.
They
early
knew that.
On, that. Yeah, that was a key step. So from in terms of early development of mummification practices, that emerges relatively early, and it becomes embedded in the religious beliefs.
I've seen pictures on your website at the museum of these, I guess, sarcophagi. They look I'm not sure what they're made out of, but they look incredibly heavy. Mm. How is it possible to either drag or create sarcophagi that were that massive?
Yeah, sarcophagi come in a whole range of shapes and sizes. There are really massive ones, especially the stone ones. One of the ones that's on the Penn website recently discovered was this huge 60-ton chamber that we found. This was actually the initial clue that led us to the discovery of Senebkai. We found a royal sarcophagus chamber made out of quartzite, a beautiful sort of reddish stone that had been quarried up near Cairo, in the region just east of Cairo, brought all the way down to Abydos, a journey of, you know, probably 400 miles on the river, this massive 60-ton chamber.
I'm trying to imagine that.
And they, not just quarrying it, but they beautifully cut it with a recess for the actual sarcophagus, which would have been a wooden container, probably an anthropoid one that has, you know, a human shape to it. Mm-hmm. That would be then lowered down into the actual sarcophagus chamber. And then a massive lid went down on top of that. Many forms of sarcophagi occur in ancient Egypt, though. The people that could afford them would usually have a nice big stone outer sarcophagus, and then a little bit like Russian nesting dolls, you'd have smaller ones inside. So there's usually a wood inner coffin, and then often an anthropoid coffin within that.
So how do you get something that size? I realize you're putting it on a boat down the Nile, but nonetheless, I'm just trying to imagine the logistics of getting.
Yeah, it's kind of mind-boggling that they did it, that they achieved it. I mean, what I could say is that the ancient Egyptians were just masters of stone masonry. I mean, just look at the pyramids of Giza. I mean, the ability to work massive blocks of limestone or granite or quartzite, move them great distances and assemble these great monuments. I mean, it relied on really organized manpower by and
slavery?
Large. We don't think slavery was a big part of it. There was slavery in ancient Egypt, but not quite in the terms that we think of it today. Mostly these large building projects, the movement of large monuments, was done by groups of men that were paid. In some cases, probably they were organized during times of the year for example, the Nile inundation arrived when the farmers weren't really doing anything in the fields. They were around. The manpower could be marshaled and used for these kinds of building projects. But yeah, it's kind of crazy to think of this.
What do you think about it?
This 60-ton block, bringing it all the way down to Abydos. It's only one part of a huge tomb. I mean, there's lots of other elements that went together to form this king's tomb.
We were talking during the break, and I didn't want to, you know, be overly dramatic, but just going into this tomb for the first time, and I guess since the robbers had been there maybe 2,000 years ago, you and your colleagues entering this tomb and seeing this this skeleton and all the remains for the first time.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, we had a couple just kind of stunned moments where we were standing there in disbelief. I mean, the first one was where we actually saw the text, the hieroglyphs on the walls naming the king. Up to that point, we hadn't really thought that this particular tomb was going to be a royal tomb. It's a relatively modest tomb. I mean, it's four chambers, beautifully built. Most of it's actually built out of mud brick and plastered. The final chamber, the burial chamber, is built out of limestone. But relatively small in scale. So we were thinking this might be sort of an elite private tomb, not a king's tomb. So when we saw the hieroglyphs, we were kind of dumbfounded. And we read them very quickly, Osiribre Senebkai. We didn't recognize the king's name. And we spent about 2 days debating who this character was. We really couldn't. I mean, usually if you find a cartouche, the oval that encloses the hieroglyphs that have the king's name, you can simply look him up in a king list and date it that way. We didn't find him anywhere. We pieced together a bunch of other evidence from the tomb initially. One of the important insights was a very kind of careful, wonderful excavation that one of my graduate students, Kevin Cahill, did. He excavated the cedar canopic chest of the king. When we first came upon that, we noticed that it had painted inscriptions, including a cartouche, a king's name on it. But the outlines of the hieroglyphs, which were a little bit eroded, were not the same as the name of Senebkai in the burial chamber. So we were initially thinking this may be actually a queen. There may be, perhaps there's a dual burial, the king and the queen here, that perhaps this is the queen's canopic chest. That turned out not to be the case. After looking at it for a day, we realized it had the name of an earlier king, this king Sobek Hotep that I mentioned. His tomb, which is actually a much larger tomb than Senebkai's, is right next to it. And Senebkai, his artisans seem to have taken cedar planks that originally belonged to the coffin of Sobek Hotep and recycled the wood. They cut it down and created a box, this canopic box. It has the earlier name of Sobek Hotep on there. And then they basically gold-plated it. They gilded the outside, covering over the earlier inscriptions.
What does that tell you?
So what that told us was that, okay, we have Senebkai. He's reusing wood from an earlier king. If they're reusing wood, it can't be too much later in time. We would suspect that. We then read the name Sobek Hotep. We connected it with the nearby tomb. And we realized that, you know, we may be looking at a relatively, you know, close time frame. We then began looking at the historical records that have been published and discussed, and came upon a very important proposal by a Danish Egyptologist named Kim Reichholdt, made back in the 1990s. He wasn't actually the first one to hypothesize this idea. There were one or two other people that talked about it, but the notion that there was a lost dynasty, he named it the Abydos dynasty. And one of the sources of information for this is an important document from ancient Egypt called the Turin King List. The Turin King List is a papyrus that was compiled in the reign of Ramses II, or Ramses the Great. One of the most famous kings of ancient Egypt. This papyrus dates to his reign. So it's about 1200 BC, a couple centuries after the period we're talking about. And it's one of the most elaborate and important king lists that's come down to us from Egyptian times. They compiled the names of kings in sequential order, recorded the lengths of their reigns, and also the total length of each dynasty. They organized the kings into dynasties. Unfortunately, the Turin King List is not in pristine condition. It's a papyrus, so there are many fragments of it. Some of the fragments are better preserved than others. And there was a section of it. I mean, there are parts of it that date to this period of time called the Second Intermediate Period. So that's, you know, roughly 1700 to 1550 BC, give or take a few years. And this guy, Kim Reichholdt, had done a very careful reanalysis of the Turin King List sections that he could attribute to the Second Intermediate Period. He proposed this Abydos dynasty, and there are these very fragmentary entries with the names of just a couple kings. And one of them, or actually the first two of them, started out with the element Woser something Re, and we found this reference. Immediately that began to make sense. There are other little clues here and there.
So this might be this lost dynasty?
Yeah, it's a very fragmentary list. There's space for at least 16 kings in the list. There may be more who are actually missing. The fragment is broken. The first two had Woser something Re. I mean, the names are very broken in their name, and this is the only occurrence of the same, what we call the throne name, as we have belonging to Senebkai. So when we saw that, looked at other pieces of evidence, it all fit together very neatly. So we're pretty sure that he's the first or the second king belonging to this dynasty. A lot of Egyptologists have doubted its existence. They've been very skeptical of it. Now I think we can conclusively prove the existence of this forgotten dynasty.
And when we talk about a forgotten dynasty, a certain time period, what kind of time period are we talking about then?
That really remains to be determined. From the Turin King List, there's certainly 16 kings, maybe more. The fragment's broken. There may be more that belong to this dynasty. Our work on the site, in and around Senebkai's tomb, we have certainly many, many other tombs of similar design, and we believe that probably all of the kings of this dynasty were buried there. There seems to be a place that was chosen. One king built a tomb, and then others kind of developed over time, adding, and the cemetery grew sort of spatially over time. Exactly how many remains to be seen, as well as the overall chronology, the date range that we're talking about.
This will come later, I guess, as you go back and begin to unearth more information.
That's going to be one of the major questions we're looking at. I mean, we suspect it's probably a dynasty of about 50 years, maybe more, roughly 1650 to 1600 BC.
Does it seem like a short dynasty to you?
It would be a relatively short dynasty, but not atypical for this particular period of time. The second intermediate period where this dynasty falls is... it's a relatively short period, but one during which Egypt was divided and fragmented, primarily into kind of two major spheres of influence, as we've understood in the past. A northern kingdom called the Hyksos Kingdom that we call Dynasty 15, and in the south, centered on the city of Thebes, there are two other dynasties that rise. We call them Dynasty 16 and 17. So the final phase of the Second Intermediate Period involved a pretty dramatic warfare between Thebes and the Hyksos Kingdom that was based at a city up in the delta in northern Egypt called Avaris. It culminated in a major event, one of the most important events of ancient Egyptian history, called the expulsion of the Hyksos, where the kings of Thebes defeated this rival kingdom in the north.
The south defeated the north.
Yeah, they took over their city. They actually... pursued them, across the North Sinai into the southern part of the Levant, and laid siege to them at another city called Sharuhen. A very dramatic series of events. But what happened? It was the foundation of Egypt's great golden age, the empire or the new kingdom, which is one of the major phases of Egyptian civilization. So all that's kind of rooted in this phase we call the Second Intermediate Period. And one of the fascinating questions with this newly identified dynasty is how did they fit into these dynamics? They were ruling in southern Egypt. Their territory abuts the Theban kingdom to the south, the ones that eventually vanquished the Hyksos. But what was their role? Are they allied with the Thebans? Are they kind of a buffer state? We're going to be looking at these questions. Discovering their necropolis is, going to add a lot of new insights into the dynamics of this era.
And we're almost up on a break here. If we're talking about the Golden Age, then we're talking about Ramses and King Tut and sort of glory dynasty of that time.
Yeah, the New Kingdom is really, it's half a millennium, dynasties 18, 19, and 20. A lot of the famous pharaohs like King Tut and Akhenaten, the female pharaoh Hatshepsut. All the Ramesside kings. Yeah, all that's rooted in the Second Intermediate Period. That's where it started.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Joseph Wegner. He's associate curator in the Egyptian section of the Penn Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. He's also an associate professor of Egyptian archaeology in the Department of Near Eastern Languages and Civilizations. And yes, we are talking about ancient Egypt and some extraordinary discoveries in recent weeks and some work that's been going on in this part of Egypt for the last couple of decades, work done by our guests and other archaeologists and other researchers. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by the Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics at Chatham University. The Pennsylvania Center for Women in Politics is hosting Ready to Run Campaign Training for Women, a one-day bipartisan training to encourage women to participate in government leadership positions. This day-long conference covers media training, fundraising, and how to develop a campaign plan. Ready to Run is Saturday, February 15th at Drexel University's McAllister Hall. Conference details and registration are available online at pcwp.org.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ann Patchett about her collection of personal essays, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. The essays are about marriage, divorce, marriage, wanting a dog more than a child, getting and raising a dog, taking care of a dying grandmother, and opening an independent bookstore after the only two remaining bookstores in Nashville closed. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Talks in Switzerland to settle the Syrian civil war, but why is the opposition so unsettled?
Now, with the recent infighting, you don't know who's who, who's where, and you certainly don't know who's winning.
The Syrian opposition seeks to settle down its own political turmoil. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Joseph Wegner about a discovery. Archaeologists working in a site called Abydos in southern Egypt announced recently that they had discovered the tomb of an unknown pharaoh named Senebkai, and evidence of a forgotten dynasty. Work has been going on in this part of Egypt for decades now. And in fact, our guest has been working there for about 20 years. We're talking about what this discovery is and what it means. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We were talking during the break about literally the kinds of tools that you use in doing this kind of archaeological work. And it sounds like not much has changed over the decades.
Yeah, as far as the site work, it's a combination of a whole range of different techniques. The major process of excavation really relies on, manpower and traditional tools. Our excavators, many of them are local farmers who have plots of land nearby that they farm on a regular basis. Right. They have a wonderful kind of hoe that they use. In Arabic, it's called a tureya. It's kind of a flat, bladed hoe. It's very good for sort of scraping small amounts of dirt off of the surface. They use this in farm work, but it also works very nicely for archaeology. They use this to scrape the surface. A lot of the workmen are very talented with it, can wield it, in a wonderful way. So work with the tureya, removing material, sand and debris. A lot of it's done sort of hand-to-hand with buckets and baskets.
Wow.
And
we tend to... Doesn't sound like it's changed too much.
No. So that physical kind of moving of earth, just based on, manpower... that hasn't changed really since the age of the pharaohs. but we also use many... more modern techniques as far as detecting things and choosing where to excavate.
Magnetometers, things like that.
We do apply subsurface techniques, geophysical techniques of subsurface detection. We've done extensive magnetometry around the site. That's quite valuable, especially where we're working, because many of the structures the Egyptians built were built made out of mud brick, essentially kind of adobe, unfired. Bricks of Nile clay, Nile alluvium. There's a lot of iron in that, so it has a positive magnetic reading when you pass over it with a magnetometer. So you can detect things that are, maybe as much as a meter underground using that technique. We're hoping to apply other techniques like radar, some other ground prospection techniques in the future, especially in trying to study this newly discovered necropolis.
Let me get, looks like Meg from Warminster to join us on Radio Times. And Meg, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm not walking, so I can't guarantee I'm going to be able to stay on. But my question is, I'm wondering how the political unrest in Egypt has affected any of the work of the archaeologists there.
Meg, it was a question I had as well. Let me get a response from our guest. Joe, go ahead.
Sure. I can certainly comment on it, especially from my own perspective. The revolution and then the second revolution recently, put a certain damper on archaeological work, especially foreign work in Egypt. There are certain parts of Egypt that were more influenced by it. One of the things that did happen in certain parts of Egypt was there was kind of local looting of sites, which the Ministry of State for Antiquities, the Egyptian ministry in charge of archaeological sites, they've been really doing sort of a heroic job in sort of combating that and preventing it from happening. In terms of actual work, though, the political events have really not had much of an influence. I mean,
Are they more urban than they might be where you are?
Yeah, I mean, Egypt remains a tremendously welcoming, largely stable country. The situation there is very unlike the situation, say, in Syria or Iraq or other parts of the Middle East. The Egyptians are incredibly welcoming. Unless you find yourself in, the midst of a political protest or something like that, life really continues on much as normal. So where we're working, we really haven't seen any kind of major influence of political events.
Meg, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm wondering, once you begin to dig these things up, do you need some kind of security to protect them, or even protect them even from the elements now that they're exposed?
Yeah, protection from the elements, that's pretty easy. We actually usually fill in, or what we call backfill, the site at the end. Typically, the mounds of sand and debris that we've removed, we put it right back in again.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, except in special cases. And one of the things we're doing at this particular site is we're hoping to open parts of it to visitors. I have a current project that's been funded by the American Research Center in Egypt to do with this large tomb that I'd mentioned at the beginning, the tomb of Pharaoh Senwasrit III. We've actually capped that. It was formerly just buried in sand, but the entrance to it is now covered by a large building with an iron door and a staircase, so we can open it and go down into it. We're hoping to do the same thing with Senebkai's tomb, because it's quite a beautiful thing, to sort of encase it in a modern building that will protect it, but also make it accessible to people. So this place may be eventually, something like a small Valley of the Kings, yeah, where people can come and see these wonderful royal tombs.
Well, again, I've seen pictures and the drawings. What really struck me is just the colors seem so vivid. And if they were, more than 3,500 years old?
Yeah, the painted decoration in this particular burial chamber was quite striking. Mm. I mean, yeah, the blues and reds and greens and everything. I mean, it's just really nice.
Vivid
condition.
Right?
Yeah, very, very vivid. And as I'd mentioned, the painting is very charming. When you look at Egyptian tombs and temples, especially the ones built during these sort of high kingdoms, they tend to be very stiff and formal, and that's the result of the Egyptian artists applying essentially sort of a grid. They would actually put a grid on the walls and use a set system of proportions for human figures. In this particular tomb, they didn't apply the grid. I mean, it's just kind of free-handed right on the wall, but it's still very characteristically Egyptian as far as the style, but I mean, it gives it this sort of charming quality, yeah, the way the human figures, these goddesses, are portrayed.
Which makes you wonder, so who was this king? I mean, I'm assuming kings had a big hand in creating their tombs.
Yeah, in many cases, one suspects that they chose the location, and B, they talked with their architects and artists to design what it looked like and what went on the walls. This guy was, as far as we understand, is a king of a dynasty centered at Abydos or near Abydos, so he probably visited the site and probably saw it himself. Senebkai. I think we're going to come to appreciate over coming years as we excavate this royal necropolis where he falls and where his dynasty as a whole falls. These are, I think, fascinating kings that we wouldn't call them great kings. Pharaohs of ancient Egypt come in all shapes and sizes. Yeah. Many of them were great monument builders if they happened to reign during a period of prosperity. But during these intermediate periods, they had a lot fewer resources at their disposal, so their tombs are smaller. They're just not quite as visible as great monument builders. Nevertheless, it is important to understand these kinds of kings that reign during these periods of flux and change. And in fact, what turns out to be the case in Egyptian history often is it's these periods of political conflict and economic downturn where a lot of the major social changes actually happen during these moments. And then things kind of restabilize during the great kingdoms, like the Middle Kingdom or the New Kingdom. So it's very fascinating to look at these intermediate periods eye to change.
And you see this as a period of what, economic instability or insecurity, perhaps?
I think we see that reflected in Senebkai's tomb itself. It's an impressive structure. Obviously included a pretty impressive burial assemblage with a lot of, sort of gold elements, as you would think a pharaoh would have. But this king was reusing materials at his disposal locally. The burial chamber, in fact, it's beautifully built out of limestone, but a lot of the blocks were taken from earlier monuments, and they have earlier inscriptions on the backs and edges. They weren't quarrying new limestone. They were reusing it from somewhere else. Similarly, the cedar wood that was used in his canopic chest that I mentioned, that's being taken from a nearby tomb of an earlier pharaoh. It suggests that this particular resource, cedar wood, which comes from the coast of Lebanon, I mean, up in the Mediterranean region. The Egyptians did import this wood. They prized it for all kinds of things. But if he's reusing it, he probably didn't have access to it. So, you know, we gain the sense of a kingdom that was probably, you know, struggling somewhat economically, didn't have quite the range of resources of, you know, a great dynasty. So we're going to, you know, be looking at that them from that angle, trying to understand the dynamics of this age.
Well, I can sense and hear and see the enthusiasm that you have. I'm curious about when you got interested in Egypt, ancient Egypt.
Oh, it goes way back.
As a kid?
As
even?
A kid, yeah. I mean, I was interested in archaeology from, I guess, probably from about 5 years of age, I guess, as I remember.
From books or digging in your backyard?
Books. I remember being fascinated. My dad had a book on Tutankhamun, one of the classic books by a French Egyptologist with beautiful illustrations of the objects from King Tut's tomb. I remember being fascinated with that. One of my favorite pictures was there's a picture of King Tut's hand, which is broken off, just kind of the fingers with the rings on it. And then on the next page is King Tut's head, and I would chase my brother around with these pictures, and he was terrified of it. I used to love that book.
That's a great way to be an Egyptologist,
yeah, of course,
isn't it?
Frightening your siblings. yeah, that book was important. I remember going to visit various museums. We lived in the UK for a number of years when I was a kid, and visiting the Ashmolean Museum with its wonderful Egyptian collections, that really sort of grabbed me.
And how about your first trip to Egypt? When was that?
I first went as a graduate student in 1991. It was actually my first year in graduate school. My advisor at the time, David O'Connor, who taught for many years at Penn and is responsible for actually establishing Penn's ongoing field work at Abydos back in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. He took us out on what turned out to be a really fascinating excavation. My first excavation, we were put into these excavation units next to an ancient building from the beginning of Egyptian history, a huge mud brick structure that dates to about 2800 BC. We were digging there and came upon these quite well-preserved boats. There were 12 of them we found that year. All in a row in brick containment structures, some of the earliest boats that are known in the world. They called it Pharaoh's Fleet at the time, and it got quite a lot of publicity. It was just a wonderful introduction to how exciting work in Egypt can be and these, you know, kind of wonderful discoveries that pop up from time to time.
And do you still sort of have that same kind of excitement when you find a Senem Kai, for instance?
Yeah, every time I go back to Egypt, you know, we always go with a sort of a set agenda. We propose everything we're going to do to the Ministry of State for Antiquities. And, you know, archaeology is a scientific discipline. We go with, you know, sort of sampling strategies and often with hypotheses that we're trying to test based on the evidence from the ground. But there's a level where it, you know, it's just sort of unpredictable and things can pop up that you just would have no idea ever were there. And, I mean, Senem Kai and the Abydos dynasty are one example of that.
Yeah.
We had thought about it. I mean, we thought, you know, there seem to be these kings, you know, maybe they're somewhere at Abydos, but I really hadn't thought about it in concrete terms, that they may have, you know, joined their royal necropolis with these earlier Middle Kingdom pharaoh's tombs at the location of Anubis Mountain. But lo and behold, they did, and now, you know, it all suddenly makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's very logical, and
Are you chomping on the bit to get back?
Of course, yes.
It looks like you're ready to go now.
I love field work. It's very enjoyable. It's not exactly a holiday. You know, we're out there. It's hard physically.
And it's very.
I'm usually
hot
out there
in
with
the summer.
You know, I take graduate students. So I mean, in a way, it's you know, we're working with students in the way that we would in the classroom. Of course, there's that element to it. But yeah, I mean, it's. It's a wonderfully rewarding thing to do, and great place to be. And the Egyptians that we work with are incredibly welcoming, so it's just a good experience all around. I do love doing it.
Yeah, I can sense that, and it's kind of a family affair. Your wife is an Egyptologist.
Yeah, my wife Jen, she's been going out with me for years and years, as long as we've been married. We actually got together in Egypt for the first time. We were
there. You go.
We were inside a pyramid together up near Memphis, the Bent Pyramid, and
Kismet.
Sort of, it was a romantic place to be, and yeah, that's where it all happened. And our son Alexander, who's now 10, he's been going since he was 9 months old, and he loves to go. He's the dig house where we live in Abydos is a great place to be and loves to.
What's a dig house? What does it look like?
We have a field house. The main part of it was built by the Penn Museum. David O'Connor, I mentioned, put it in place in the late 1960s. It's been expanded over the years. The overall use of the house includes actually a number of institutions that are working in different parts of Abydos. So New York University is also a kind of major sponsor of the house, and other, you know, other projects working in Abydos and its environs are using the house as well. It's a great place, it's designed really to support the archaeological team in the field. It has bedrooms and workrooms.
Electricity, running
it
water?
It has electricity. It didn't always have electricity. The first time I went there, there was no electricity, no water. It was pretty rough going, especially in the winter time, where it's incredibly cold in Egypt. You don't think of Egypt as being cold, but the winter can be, you know, in the 30s sometimes. We also have storerooms there. A lot of the finds that that come out of the ground, we store them right on site, and we don't take anything from Egypt anymore. So it all stays on site, and when we return, we can analyze it there at the dig house.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations on your work, and keep on digging.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you as well. That's Joseph Wegner, Associate Curator in the Egyptian Section of the Penn Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program. You can also go to the Penn Museum's website as well, and you can see pictures of the Abydos site. Bob Ball is the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.